Namo tassa bhagavato rahato sammasambuddhassa. The traditional beginning to a Dhamma talk in Asia, just recollecting the Buddha and appreciation for the inheritance of the Buddha and the tradition goes on, and why I am here giving a talk as a result of 25 centuries of passing it from one generation to the next. Some critical information for addressing central issues in human existence. So we always kind of give a little homage to the Buddha. That's what I was saying. Namo tassa is an homage or an honoring of the Buddha. Just like to talk a little bit more about walking meditation and sitting meditation, just in brief. There are many schools of walking meditation. You may have been familiar with the Burmese school, essentially probably created by Mahasi Sayadaw. It's a very slow motion type of walking, and where each step is articulated sometimes into three or four different motions. That school also slows down all movements, including eating and so forth. So that's one approach to things, a valid approach, useful. There are other approaches. Depending on the school that's teaching it, you will usually see some sort of manifestation of the general attitude of the people who flock together in that school, the birds of a feather that flock together in that school. Why do the Burmese schools walk in slow motion, dividing the steps into four or five parts? Why in Zen monasteries do they walk all in a circle, following each other, and sometimes running and sometimes walking? Why in the forest edition do we go off and walk individually at our own pace? Because of each of these are manifestations of the attitude that's being brought to the Dhamma. In Burma, the Dhamma is very influenced by what is called Abhidhamma, very technical explorations of the word of the Buddha. An investigation of the minute, a sort of a virtually scientific investigation of the workings of the mind and breaking things down into detail, taking everything apart like a Swiss watchmaker taking a watch apart. And when they put it back together, there's a residual attitude, having taken this thing apart at such a minute level. Their attitude towards existence is to see it as a thing to be taken apart, and so it's not surprising that they have developed this slow motion walking technique with separating the individual movements of the steps, etc. In the Zen community, Zen is influenced by the Mahayana philosophy, and it's very much notion of interdependence of beings and a very communal cooperation. So often the walking meditation is done as a group and follow the leader kind of style. And whatever the leader does, you do. If they go fast, you go fast. If they go slow, you go slow. That's also an element of the Theravada tradition. However, there's again an acknowledgement of individuality and the expression of your uniqueness. So in the forest tradition, follows very closely the kind of instructions or the kind of walking meditation that was done right at the time of the Buddha. It really develops out of the situation. original reason for walking meditation was a suggestion by the Buddha, the Buddha's physician, Jivika, that when monks were living in an area where the food was rich, and there was heavy, rich food being offered to them, if you only eat once a day, it's a little bit heavy on the stomach, and they were getting a little sick. It's like being pregnant every day. You know? So he suggested, well, the best thing for this is that they have an opportunity for walking after the meal. And so in order to do this, since they're living in the middle of the jungle, and if you've never lived in the middle of the jungle, you know, unless there's a cleared space, you can't walk around. It's all heavily overgrown. The only place to walk is outside the jungle, back in the village. Because you usually live near a village in order to go alms round. But you're not supposed to go back to the village. That's why you're in the forest. So then they had to have special permission to clear walking paths beside their dwellings. So eventually every monk, and traditionally every forest monk, has a walking path specially cleared beside their dwelling. And of course it's very flat, smooth, and you can't just go on winding through the jungle forever. It's not that you take a stroll. Because by 6 o'clock in the evening in the tropics, it's pitch black. And of course all you have is, maybe you have a candle. So you put a candle at the end of the path, and you can see enough that in the evening if you're sleepy, you might have been up since 3 a.m. You can shrug off sleep by going out and walking, doing an hour of walking meditation, 2 hours, 3 hours. If you're that type of person, you know, a physically oriented person who enjoys that kind of the motion and that finds it beneficial, you might walk 3 or 4 hours in the evening until, say, 10 at night. So those are some of the functions of walking meditation to... Actually, even for the sense of health, one of the reasons why the Buddha says walking meditation is good is it aids digestion. We all know this. And it keeps you in shape for going on walking tours. Because in those days, how else could a monk travel? And they had to travel. So if you're gonna go on a 100-mile walk every now and then, you have to keep up a little bit on as well. So good for that. Good for waking you up when you're sleepy. Good for refreshing the body, stretching, so forth. So these are the kind of parameters that the Buddha assigned for these, and the development of a walking path, a very specific place to walk. Of course, that's part of the environment they were in. Again, that's incidental to the exercise. The fact is that you can't just sit there all day and all night. You have to move your body around. So when you do move your body around, this is coming back just to the basics, so that you have a sense when you see any of these different styles and so forth, you can go back to the origin and see how this developed and what the Buddha himself said about this, is that when you're walking, be mindful that you're walking. That is the beginning, middle, and end of the instructions for walking meditation from the Buddha. When walking, one knows when it's walking. This is a good instruction to give yourself at the beginning of every walking meditation. I'm going to be walking now. Let me know that I'm walking. See if I can sustain the awareness that I am walking. Having just finished a walking meditation, I'm sure you realize that the incredible clouds of thoughts and drifting and planning and proliferation of processes that happen in the middle of walking, even between two steps. It's quite a task, the art of walking meditation is a high art, a fine art, to just be there walking without inflicting any sort of unnecessary rigidity or tension or specialness about it. You're just walking. You happen to be walking in a building or in a restricted area, so you won't be walking that fast. And since you're not having to walk fast, you don't have to swing your arms. So you can sort of collect your arms, either in front or behind. Some teachers are very specific about where you put the arms. There's nothing specific by the Buddha, but some of the great teachers of Thailand, the great forest monks, said, keep them in front, clasped like this. The reason for this is that it requires some effort or attention to do this. If you rest them behind in the typical philosopher's walk, the philosopher's position, or they just, it's very easy. They somehow stay there by themselves. But perhaps there's a little less attention required. I wouldn't go so far as to say there is any right place to put your arms. You can just note the difference in your mind. If you want something more to help your mind stay here, you might hold your hands in front, sort of requiring a deliberate attention. If your shoulders are getting tired, maybe you will put your arms behind. At the end of the walking path, your chosen area, and it's always good to delimit the area again. And if you're walking outside, remember that it's not really a walking tour. You're not actually going out to appreciate trees or anything like that. They'll be incidental in the background. It'll be there. But that's why you have this sort of limited walking area. You don't have to decide every now and then where you're going to go next. So when we usually go for a walk, we kind of go out there to, again, to fulfill our desires or curiosity. There's goals in mind, and the walking meditation is just an extension of sitting meditation, that we're not going anywhere. Our goal is just this step, just the one under our foot, not how many times we managed to walk back and forth in half an hour. Did we beat our old record? Must be good for my heart. Cardiovascular benefits, at least the aerobics are good. No, we're going to try and forget about the attempt to develop perfect health or anything like that. It does make you feel a little bit refreshed and well, and you can feel it. It's a very natural thing to do without any thinking of those other extensive benefits. Again, I should repeat the Buddha's comment that about walking meditation, that if concentration is developed while walking, it tends to be strong and last. The reason why is that walking is less or is more conditional than sitting. Sitting, nothing's going on at all. It's kind of the least conditional posture, except for lying down. Well, what's wrong with lying down then? Why don't we just lie down? Only one little problem. Sleepy. You go to sleep when you lie down to meditate. So the question is it all right if I lie down while I meditate? No. Is it all right if I meditate while I lie down? Yes. So when you lie down, you can meditate. But don't lie down to meditate. Sitting posture is, you're more inclined to stay awake. You can see that even there, sleepiness can arise. And but the least likely area where sleepiness is going to arise is walking meditation. Of course, there's also standing meditation. When you're walking, you don't always have to walk. You may feel very, there's two reasons for stopping and just standing there. One is that your mind is just running. It's like taking a dog for a walk, you know, an 8-month-old German Shepherd out to the park. And the moment they're off the leash, they're just all over the place. Sometimes you just have to stop and you wait until it comes back and you put it back on the leash. It won't. If it's going to run all over the park, it's got to be on the leash. So this is also the nature of the mind. if you find your mind is just running all over the park, and you just have to stand there and say, I'm just going to stand here until you come back. You know, we're not going on with this walk until you come back here. So it's a way of doing something unusual. We don't usually just stand there. That is a very unusual thing for us. That is for me, anyway. everybody has their little idiosyncrasies in life, and perhaps somebody feels very natural just standing there in the middle of the kitchen. I know that happens in the front of the refrigerator sometimes. That moment of paralysis when you're not really hungry, but you're a bit bored and you can't decide what to eat, and you stand there, letting the heat out of the refrigerator. But this is two possibilities. One is that your concentration is getting very good and you're feeling very peaceful. And then you all just enjoy standing there. At the end of your walk, maybe your 45, 50-foot walk, you just stand there and close your eyes. You can't close your eyes while you walk. This is something... Now when I teach walking meditation, I mention this, because sometimes in classes or beginner's meditation, after the sitting, I tell everybody to sit down there and close their eyes and concentrate. And then I introduce walking meditation, I describe it, and they get up and start walking, and then I see them walking with their eyes closed across the room, you know, bumping into things. And stuff. Oh, I forgot to mention, when you walk, keep your eyes open. So you can't overlook the obvious. But when you stand, you can close your eyes. You can stand there and close your eyes at the end of it. To kind of, again, an even more better situation for pulling the mind back. Or just even kind of resting while being up. It's the next best thing to sitting. So don't overlook standing meditation. Again, especially in sitting groups like this, where in the morning, you know, the 5:30 sitting, or maybe the afternoon, like the 2 o'clock sitting, if you've had a fairly substantial lunch, you haven't had much sleep, been up since 5, or maybe because it's a strange place, you didn't get much sleep the night before, or maybe you worked the night shift. I forgot to mention it, but you did have the option of sleeping through the first sitting this morning. Sorry. Forgot to tell you that. I always usually mention that, out of compassion for people who are coming in out of the world, because you have very busy lives. It's amazing. The last retreat I taught, I said, you know, I don't know where you're coming from. You might have been working the night, you know, 12-hour night shift for the last 2 weeks and trying to move and do a few things like that all at one shot, and you're really tired. And you come to this retreat because you want to meditate, and you're not here. It's not like you have to go to school and you have to come here or anything like that. You're here because you want to be. So if you're really tired, really exhausted because of the demands of the world, it's all right to miss that, you know, just show up for the breakfast the first morning. Or even now, if you're too exhausted, it's possible to rest. Monks live a different lifestyle. We have a very, you know, we live in a kind of serene environment, and we have fairly regularity to our lives. When I'm being chauffeured around in the back seat of or in a car with people who are making it out there in the world on my way to retreats and so forth, I hear all the things they have to take care of. Go to work, take those kids to the soccer game, and be back, sell their house, get the groceries. Uncle so-and-so is coming too. And it's like, mostly, you know, if two monks are sitting in a car, what they're saying to each other in the back, you ever wonder what those monks are whispering back there? They're saying, I wonder how they do it. How do they do it? How do they keep it up? We're just appreciating your endurance to manage to keep the battery going at all in the world. This is, of course, why we do retreats as well, is that you can recharge your battery and get some stability and get reoriented a little bit before you go back into it. So, standing meditation, is if you're really tired in the morning sitting and you keep nodding off, you're not trapped completely. You can't just get up and start walking around the room. But you can stand up. Just very quietly stand behind your cushion and open your eyes. Look at the candles. Look at the light. And it's a waking kind of experience. Also in the afternoon sitting, sometimes the heaviness of the meal makes you, the 2 o'clock sitting can be often very difficult the sleepiness is not quite left, or it's coming, it's entering, and so standing behind your cushion is an option. It doesn't disturb anything. They're sitting with their eyes closed, they don't know it. So that's a little bit about the walking meditation and standing meditation. And it's again the attitude you're bringing to it. This is a beautiful opportunity. You have to talk to yourself a little bit. Say, yes, what a wonderful opportunity just to be completely here. No worries or concerns. This is the kind of mind that you've had somewhere along the line, maybe on a holiday, the time you've traveled around Europe, or were off in Greece, or just down at the beach, or camping, when you had let go of the busyness and burdens, and you were just out in nature somewhere, maybe walking on a beach, or just walking in the forest, or you realized the point was not to go anywhere, it was just to be there, it was a wonderful thing to be there. Try to remember that. What does that feel like? What is that attitude? Sometimes those are the most remarkable memories of our life. We try to reproduce those memories. That's why we go back to the beach. That's why we go back to the forest. We remember that something happened there. We had a moment, an hour, or an evening, or even 2 weeks, some point in our life, was kind of magical, full of peace and energy. Peace and energy together. They go together. Peace and energy go together. And when we weren't agitated or driven, try to recall that mind and bring that mind to your walking meditation, just to walk with peace, delight, ease, joy, energy. These are all the mind states that we're encouraging. We're not just whatever happens. We are trying to deliberately invoke a mind state. And obviously not a negative mind state. There's no reason for that. Positive mind state. Mindfulness is just one of the factors of enlightenment, factors that lead to enlightenment. They're classically listed as 7 factors of enlightenment. And they're all extremely positive. Beautiful mind states. Mindfulness, so you're being mindful of your body, you're mindful of walking, mindful of a topic, such as the impermanence of things. When mindfulness is present, then the investigation can follow. Investigation and reflection. You become aware. You notice things that you didn't notice before, because you're collected and mindful. And when you notice things that you haven't noticed before in a certain way, at a higher level of observation, then what follows is energy. You become energized by this process. That is the 3rd factor of enlightenment. When energy is there, you cannot what must follow from mindful, reflective energy is joy. We call piti, or joy. Joy must follow. And when joy is there, energy and joy eventually has a result, an outcome. The next thing that follows from it naturally is serenity. The word, the Pali word is pasadi. An even tranquil energy. And this is another factor of enlightenment. And then we have concentration comes from these, the preceding factors all lining up and starting to support each other and all being there. They don't just dissolve or disappear. When when investigation comes up, mindfulness isn't left behind. It's still there, it's part of investigation. When energy comes up, it doesn't leave mindfulness or investigation behind. They're still there. When joy comes up, it doesn't absolve energy. Energy is still there. When tranquility comes up, it doesn't mean that energy or joy have disappeared. They're still there. And then finally, when concentration comes up, it means that the other five are all there as well. And it's because they're all there that concentration appears and must appear. Remember that we're talking about conditions? We've arranged the prior conditions, and now concentration appears. Concentration is a loaded word. It's often associated with stress, but it's not that kind of concentration. It is focus. And maybe a person who is experiencing that type of concentration would maybe use the word stillness rather than concentration. Centeredness, I like the word, it can extract the word centered out of concentration. You're with your center. You're now focused and with your center. And finally, at the end of all of this, because of all of this development, is equanimity. Equanimity is the sense of being perfectly in balance. All of the factors of your mind are perfectly in balance. These are all, of course, who could think of anything more positive? These are all extremely positive mental states, and these are what we are deliberately trying to cultivate in this retreat and in your life in general. These are the factors of enlightenment. They develop, and they must be balanced and observed. And when they are present, you have to know what's present. When you're feeling energy, know it. Say, I'm finding energy. What's associated with this? What preceded this? Is this a joyful experience? Is it fading on me? How do I get it back? How do I restore it? How do I boost it? Is it becoming agitation now? Is there too much energy there? I have to go back a step and think about the factor of tranquility. I have to infuse tranquility into this to bring energy back to that where it's beautiful rather than agitated. It's the difference between one cup of coffee and four. One cup of coffee is just energizing. Four is agitating. So one has to be aware. And what is the, what's the solution? When you're aware and mindful, not caught up and just compulsively doing this, the solution is that balance, evaluation. If you just had a meal and you have a cup of coffee, then there's some sort of balance there. If you're sitting in a coffee shop with nothing in your stomach, just putting coffee back because the conversation's interesting and there's nothing else to do, then the balance goes off. And the conversation gets faster and faster and faster and faster. More agitated, disconnected. So these factors have to be looked at, dwelled on, brought up, sustained. Every one of them is extraordinarily beautiful. So that when you walk, you think, I'm endeavoring to do here something very beautiful. I'm looking very deliberately to bring beautiful mental states up. Not just mental states, but states of the heart up. I'm going to bring these up while I walk back and forth. And this one, walking back and forth, is also one of the things we do well. We don't run very well. As an animal, we're not very good at running. We can get by, stump around on a couple of legs, but a three-legged dog can just outrun, any. But we do walk very well. We really are quite good at walking. It's a very graceful, not demanding. It doesn't hurt the body or anything like that. So we do that very well. It's very good for us. So in the midst of walking and sitting, we are cultivating these positive mental states, looking to bring them up, looking to sustain them. In this case, we're not interested in watching them disappear. The overall attitude of Vipassana is to sort of watch things rise, sustain, and disappear. And this is the instructions given in the mindfulness discourses of the Buddha, to watch things rise, sustain, and disappear. However, when he talks about the factors of enlightenment, he never talks about rising, watching them rise and disappear. He only talks about watching them rise, cultivating them, and sustaining them. He's not interested in their disappearance. He's interested in that they remain. And that's so we are interested in bringing these things up, developing, cultivating, and sustaining them. If and when they do go, we of course must be aware. It is absent. We have seen, we witnessed something disappear. Aspect of what we think of as ourself has disappeared. Our duty then is to go and get it again and bring it up, cultivate it, and sustain it. With sitting, again, when I sit down, I like the image of sitting by a campfire at night on a beach. The same kind of mind. You're taken out of your normal environment, and you have the sense of tranquility of the stars above, and the elements, water, ocean, sand, fire, air, the feeling of moving air, the temperature, and that's a very appropriate type of conditions for developing the mind that we want to develop. So when you sit down to close your eyes, I mean, where are you? Recall what it's like when you sit. What is your mind when you sit down on a beach at night with the fire going? It's very different. It's not boring, is it? It's enlivening. But at the same time, there's not a lot of sensory input. It's not like watching TV or watching a movie or reading a novel or even having a talk with somebody. It's a different type of very beautiful experience. So that again, it's the when you sit down to contemplate the fire, to feel the elements, to feel what it's like to be in nature. You're setting aside your preconceptions and filters. And so that's the same with sitting meditation. You sit down with that same attitude, that same mood in mind. Recently, I was invited to give a talk in Seattle in something that's happening across the states and has been for the last few years called Change Your Mind Day. And they have it out in the parks. And various Buddhist groups sponsor it. Nice. Zen groups and mindfulness groups and Theravada groups and et cetera. And the first ones were done in Central Park in New York City. And they invited Buddhist teachers, monks and nuns and the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and all these teachers, lay teachers as well, and to just go out into the park, and they set up a speaker system in the middle of the park and a nice little sort of sun shelter there, and just give a talk to anybody who wants to stop and listen. And people wander through and they sit down and on the grass and they listen. So ours was to give a 25-minute Dhamma talk in the middle of the park, impromptu, there's no charges, it's all freely sponsored and so forth. And then a 5-minute guided meditation. And so it was a very beautiful experience. And it happens all on the same day across the big American cities now, Chicago and New York, and Los Angeles, Seattle, a few others. Change Your Mind Day. Well, what struck me about the title, Change Your Mind Day, is, I wonder if you can do it. Can you change your mind? How would you do it if you could? It changes all the time in itself, doesn't it? It is, the essence of it, if, as you've been watching, is it changes. How can you change it in the direction that you want it to go? One of the best ways, as I meditated on the notion of change your mind day, was that basically instead of change your mind day, it should really be mind your change day. It is, and of course that goes in two directions, doesn't it? We're all pretty good at minding our change out in the world, you know, the change from the money. We pay attention. We pay attention to that. We mind our change. Make sure we count our change. But we don't mind our change in the spiritual direction. We don't mind the changes of the mind. So, this retreat every day is not change your mind day, it's mind your change day. And it is bringing our attention to change itself. Change is anicca, the nature of impermanence. One of the three characteristics that the Buddha pointed out is universal. It's found everywhere. No, there's nothing outside of that change. And that is where insight is going to appear, by dwelling on change rather than dwelling on the attempt to stabilize. The attempt to arrange a situation in life that will last and be secure, that only increases tension and stress because you can't do it. It is always subject to change. And that's the mark of the genius of the Buddha. He's saying, what will happen if you just accept this truth of change, that everything is changing, that you will feel a release from the pressure and stress of resisting the change, insisting that you can arrange some situation that's stable and lasting. And so this is what we are doing. This is where we're directing our attention to. Change itself, not without resistance to it. You have to let go at a deep existential level. Say, what have I been doing all my life? I've been telling myself a story, an incredibly false story about life, about how I'm going to get it arranged and how I'm going to get it in line and get it straightened out and get it stabilized and make things go the way I want them to do. No wonder I feel tense. No wonder I feel stressed at the deepest level. Because that's impossible, what have I been telling myself? It can't happen. What I have to do is start reversing. How much exercise have I done? How many times have I done this? How many times have I cultivated the habit and the attitude? Not just at intellectual level, but at the deepest level, the gut level. Even below the gut level, where you don't even know what's down there, but you know that there's something down there that's not right. And it's only by starting to reverse this whole process and feed in the correct information, a true report of reality. There's a beautiful simile that Buddha gives. Two messengers come to a walled city, and the king lives in the center of the walled city. And they approach by six, there are six roads leading to the walled city. And these messengers enter, and there's a gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper asks, what's your message? And they report the message. If the gatekeeper says affirms that the message is true, then they can proceed on to the king. The two messengers are serenity and insight, giving an accurate report of reality. They come by way of these roads. They come by way of the six senses, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. Whatever you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, feel, think, is if you want, an accurate report is given to consciousness. The king is consciousness at the center of the crossroads in the middle of the city. An accurate report of reality is always has two elements to it. There's serenity and insight. And the insight is, out in the kingdom, everything is impermanent. And this report is accompanied by stability and serenity. That is why we try to cultivate serenity, so that we can not we can receive this truth and deliver this truth to ourselves without it agitating us and being fearful, creating fear and anxiety. It's a truthful report. It is not, and people, we are naturally shying away from it because it goes against our type of preparations and reports that we've given ourselves before. We have to give ourselves the truth, but we have to be sitting down to hear it. You know that. You know when you have to tell somebody some news about reality. You like them to be in a. You like to arrange the condition, prearrange the condition a little bit. Sit down. I have something to tell you. Or let's sit in a certain environment. You know, maybe let's step out of the mall here. Just sit down here and want to tell you something. This is the same way when you do this to yourself. You must make sure that you're in a good, stable, serene condition to give yourself the news, the nature of reality. The gatekeeper is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the one making sure that the reports that come in regarding reality are accurate, or it doesn't admit it to consciousness. If mindfulness is haphazard, all kinds of false or distorted notions of reality are coming in, giving one false reports, and then, of course, you can't administer the kingdom in a reasonable way. So we want to observe change. We want to mind our change. And if you want to take it one step further, you have to ask, what is minding the change? Who is minding the change? It's very important that we ask that question as well, that we don't leave the thing that's minding the change out of the change. Because that's the sense of self, that there's some stable self seeing change. I think, yeah, it's good to see change. And we got this, the king at the center of the crossroads. What end up? It's change, finding change. The process of observation is just a process. Change, minding change. That's who you are. That's what you are. It's change, minding change. Instead of stability, minding, hoping for stability. That's what we usually are. A false notion that there's a stable entity called me that remains the same under all the changing conditions. And every now and then you get a jarring dispute about that, and you realize that it's not, you're not stable. So we reverse our approach. We keep reflecting on change, and we keep reflecting that it's change, minding change. So we end up dissolving a separate sense of separateness from reality. We, as if we're a little thing that's separate, hard, and alienated, and outside the rest of the universe, looking on through the bars and can never get in, in a little glass cage. It isn't that way. There is no separate, removed entity. That's just a concept. A false model that has been developed in the mind. You look in yourself, you'll find nothing that is just not flowing, changing, moving. You won't find a stable entity called me. It's just rivers running into rivers, merging in rivers, falling off waterfalls into the ocean. Nothing. It's just artificial. If you don't take the names of those, the bow and the elbow river. Somebody had a sense of humor in Calgary. You know? These are not really things, are they? They're just water. And if they merge, they go anywhere. If they evaporate out, it's just water merging. We are just the universe. I'm the universe, you're the universe. The universe is talking to the universe. The universe sitting, talking with itself, using its universal language, the way it talks to itself. I sitting here talking to you, the universe talking to itself. That's the way it does it. What do you think you are? Something other than the universe, or I'm something other than the universe? The universe talking to the universe. What is your just consciousness grabs the earth and walks away. Manipulates the earth, walks around with it, then talks to itself, and observes itself. We forget this. We remove ourselves. We make ourselves separate entities, alienated, and all of the things from that wrong view that follow are stress, tension, anxiety, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, because we get the wrong picture of the situation. Big knot, and all kinds of heroic myths and stories are about encountering tangles and mazes, having to go through mazes and come out the other side without losing the thread of mindfulness. That's how you do it. Or encountering the Gordian knot, a huge thing that can never be untied. You remember what the hero does? Remember what Alexander the Great, the Gordian knot hanging in the cave that nobody could ever undo, this massive tangle. Remember that Alexander the Great, you have heard that name. He's not that long after the Buddha. Almost 25 centuries ago. He was dead by 28. He managed to conquer most of the known world by the age of 28. So he's a fairly direct kind of guy. This big tangled knot, he wanted to see this, and he walked in there and said, this is, nobody's been able to ever untie this. He just hauled out his sword and just cut it in half. It's done. I mean, that's cheating, right? But that in a sense is what we have to do. That, what is that? Why is that story there? Maybe it didn't happen, but it is the nature of the truth of our tangle. Huge, tangled knot of condition, and we have to haul out the sword. Wisdom is always symbolized by the sword. If you don't untie this thing, you're wasting your time. No matter how skillful your fingers are, you don't untie this thing. One day you say, why am I untying this thing? I don't have to untie this thing. I just get out the sword and cut it in half. Just cut it. Yeah? That is what the approach is. Instead of solving all of these problems, the origination of the problem is the false problem originating around a false sense of self. Wisdom cuts through this, cuts through the false sense of self, not falls away. So I'll leave that with you today for a reflection, morning reflection, to motivate you through the day and for your own reflection, not to be regarded as any sort of authoritative truth, but it's just things to work with, reflections to work with, to see what it is. What are we here doing? Many things, this can be a very rich experience. This is a fine art. This is the art of all arts, the meditative, reflective art, serenity and insight. The only game in town. So all of the great names of history, that's what they were up to. And that's what you're up to here. And this is where we solve
and dissolve things at a radical and deep level. And so I invite you to do your best.
All right, with this question and answer box, it's got quite a little deck of cards here. It tends to build up as the retreat goes on. Barbara was mentioning about your, quote, isness. Please tell us more about what keeps you so busy. Well, see, business is, or maybe it should be busyness. Well, I'm not all that busy. These days, I suppose I am, because I make this yearly tour around Canada. Hit Calgary, Ottawa, Edmonton. Ottawa and Edmonton will be 10-day retreats. And we happen to be in the middle of finding a new monastery. We actually have found one. And put an offer to purchase on it. And so this involves also selling the old monastery. And it's an enormous building that is not quite finished. And so a lot of extra details to it all. So it's an interesting part of life. I have lots of help in doing these things. So there's about half a dozen of us that are busy doing this. But well, I suppose the busyness of the spiritual life, just being in the monastery, it's a tranquil but active life. Every day is something like this. You're up at least, the day starts at 5 every morning or earlier. In the forest monasteries of Thailand, the usual rising time is 3 in the morning. The bell goes off at 3. And some people have trouble. Yeah. He says, well, you don't have to get up when they ring the bell. You always get up before that. But anyway, I wouldn't call it a busy life compared to the way most people live. It's I commute to work in the morning. It's a nice commute. I don't resent the commuting to work. I have a little cabin up on a hill that's about 100 feet above the main monastery building. I step out and I look across the valley. It's all forested there. And there's this little path that leads down. It's about, 400 yards or something down to the monastery. So I proceed to commute to work down there. Sometimes there's a big traffic jam of deer on the path, or I have to get blocked at an intersection stepping over flowers or something. But generally, it's not too stressful going to work. Only in the winter, when you have to watch out for ice. It's a very steep kind of hill and not really well designed for walking down in ice. So that's how the day begins for me. And then, of course, we sit for an hour. And then, just like here, there's this bowl of friendliness called oatmeal in the morning. And the breakfast at the monastery is a talking breakfast. I think it's a good time for people to just relax and have their morning coffee and their bowl of oatmeal. And the monks sit in the same room with the lay people. And people are fairly relaxed, so they have a chance to informally ask questions, talk about things. So it's a good opportunity. And then the day goes on from there. Usually, it's not. The morning is kind of a silent period till the main meal at 11, and that's a silent meal again, just like here. After lunch, individuals have a chance to talk to me if they want interviews. So I hang about for a while. Usually, one or two people will talk, maybe half an hour. Then there has been things to attend to, just deciding to do with this new monastery as far as
finding out about building codes and that. But normally speaking, the afternoon would just be off again on one's own to. We have separate little cottages around the seven little spots out on the land, cabins or trailers, and then six individual rooms in the main house. And people either go off on their own to do that, or they go for a walk through the areas. Present monastery is surrounded by crown land. One can go off walking, and or sit in the meditation hall. Or we have lots of also some Dhamma tapes from monks and lay teachers from around the world, and a very substantial library growing at an astonishing rate. We try to keep it not too entertaining, mostly on Dhammic topics. So people basically live in a rather harmonious way and tranquil way. And then tea time is 4:30, just like here. And again, that's a talking, that's an opportunity. I usually give a talk or a reading at tea time. And the tea times often go on for an hour and a half, 2 hours sometimes, just talking about various things, just like more or less the, like question and answer period here. And then evening meeting, 7 o'clock. We do a little bit of chanting at these meetings. Nothing very elaborate. Most of our chants are, we've translated into English, so. And most of them are just basically on topics of meditation. And then after that, the rest of the evening from 8 or 8:30 on is free for anybody to do their own practice. And then the day starts again at 5 in the morning. So that's what I do when I'm in the monastery, and when I'm traveling, this is what I do. You're going to see exactly what I do. So that's the business of monastic life. But it is a very busy, active life. I remember reading this phrase in one of the sayings of the Buddha, you know, that this, the holy life is the beginning of the active life. And I thought, people sitting around all the time don't seem very active, but you see what an endeavor it is to actually pay attention. In a sense, the distracted life or the busy life is not really all that active. It's often avoiding the real critical issues of facing ourselves. A lot of our activity is out there just trying to get away from ourselves. So it's certainly not dull. It's certainly the richest adventure one can have is to sit and be with oneself, to struggle not to escape from oneself, to face oneself. It's a great adventure. It requires a great deal of activity right from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, and even into your dreams. Ajahn Chah would sometimes ask if somebody was doing breath meditation, say, it's good, you know, paying attention to in-breath and out-breath. Then he'd ask, so when you woke up this morning, were you breathing in or out? And you leave you thinking about that, and then you'd just be ready to answer that one, and then you say, so which one did you fall asleep on, out-breath or in-breath? Right to the last possible millisecond of consciousness, attempting to be mindful, alert, alive. Might as well live. You know, this is it. So it's a very intensely, you're attempting to live intensely and fully and completely in the moment all the time. So outwardly people think it's an inactive life, but it's actually the most demanding and active and rewarding life, certainly of the compared to the lifestyles that I've led as a layperson. It's every bit as rich. It's an art. You're making an art of your life, an art form of your life. You're making your whole life a work of art. And just as with a work of art, you commit to it and strive to. Or to that expression of the good, the true, and the beautiful in your life.
And then the next one is along the same lines. I purposely sorted them out that way. Please give us some information about your monastery before the end of the retreat. Well, the new monastery is just near Kamloops, 550 kilometers from Calgary. And it just purchased it. It's 80 acres and is very remote. The nearest building to it is 10 kilometers away. So we deliberately searched for really secluded land. So there's no other buildings for 10 kilometers in any direction. Surrounded on all sides by crown land, and the property owns the south end of a private lake, and there's no one else on that lake, so it's the property fronts on a little lake about a couple kilometers long. And there's an enormous building on it of at least the size of this building, I think, about well over 9,000 square feet. We hadn't actually been looking for a building. We were looking for land. But then things changed, and we happened to be shown this place, and it seemed to be ideal as a monastery. This fellow had spent 2 years building it, thinking that he was building a private lodge for three families. And turned out all that time that he was actually building a monastery. Because he ran out of money and couldn't get the other two families to come in with him, and so he bought it. So it happens to be very, very similar design to this. It's like open cathedral ceilings, perfect for a meditation hall, and all glass front of 10 meters of glass looking out over the lake. So it makes a very nice meditation hall, very spacious, about the size of the hall downstairs. And then there's all kinds of accommodation. There's accommodation in the house for about 18 or 20 people. And there's an outbuilding as well, very suitable for a little complex of five or six sort of rooms out there. And we also live, we like to have solitude, especially the monks. We live in little separate cabins. These are traditionally called kutis. Monks' dwellings, these little one-room cabins. And so we will sprinkle about half a dozen or 10 around the property. So the monastery will have accommodation for 30 people, 20 lay people, and up to 10 monastics. And we live there, the monks live there all year round. And there's a good growing number of applicants to become monks now. We have at least four that will take up the robes shortly. And so we will quickly expand to having six monks there. And the facilities are very, very good, ideal for a retreat. It's totally silent there, outside and inside. So, and of course it's completely designed for nothing but meditation retreats. And so we will start working on it on July 15th, and we expect it to be finished in a month or two. It's 90% complete as it is. But we certainly invite everybody here to come and visit and stay with us. It's a different atmosphere because it's exclusively designed, and the whole place is nothing but a place for a retreat. It's a little less, the ongoing retreat structure is a little less formal in here. We do have a chance to talk at breakfast and at coffee time and so forth, and if possible go out and have a walk with somebody and have a chat. And people come and stay anywhere from a day to a month or even more. Some have stayed 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. We also will have, now that we have more facilities, we'll have kind of regular opportunities for sort of 10 formal 10-day retreats along this line. Probably 3 or 4 of those a year will be available. So if a person wants a kind of a taught retreat, a sort of continuously instructed formal retreat where everything is scheduled and time and so forth, then they can come to that. And then if they feel that they would like to, either they're not ready for that, or they want to try their more of an individual type of retreat, then they can come at
at any of the other times. We're open about 9 months out of the year continuously for lay retreats. In the winter, we go into the monks go into retreat, and we leave a group of lay people to sort of run the monastery while the monks just go off to their little cabins, and we come in just for one meal a day and spend the 3 months, January, February, March, just in seclusion. Get together with the lay people in the house. Last winter we had five lay people who ran the place and stayed there through the winter, and the monks, not the Kutis. We would come in on the full moon and new moon, and we would have a group all night sitting till dawn. And so that's kind of been the schedule, and that will probably be that way for quite some time. We've been sort of developing. This is the third monastery that I've established in BC in a sequence, starting from a broken down shack, which we rented for $50 a month. And then eventually we managed to purchase the present property, which is about 18 acres with an accommodation for about 12 or 13. And we've been there for 3.5 years, and now it seems to be blossoming into larger things. This will be the last move we'll make, foreseeably. In other words, who knows? But we have no intention of going anywhere else now. And this will be a permanent monastery. I do have a bunch of pictures that I brought along, and I'll pass it around at the end of the retreat. You can take a look at it. And as I say, we welcome you to come and visit us. There's no charge for anything. All facilities of the monastery are without charge. The monastery is supported by just donations freely given by all kinds of people all over the place. Some people have never visited there, and they support it by... In the Asian tradition, monasteries are... The lay people support the monks. And so often they may not even meditate, but they like to support the monastery. And as well, people... We had last year 500 guests in 9 months stay with us. And that was the previous year 350, the previous year 150. So you see, it's almost, it's increasing by 50 to 60% every year in terms of the number of people who come and stay. And a lot of people come back again. It's a very pleasant environment, and specifically designed for it. It's always there, so you don't have to sort of plan 6 months in advance to take your holidays for your 10-day retreat. It's there. And not that far from Calgary. Okay, on to other things. My right leg goes to sleep after about 15 minutes of meditating. Very distracting. Any suggestions? That's a very common complaint by meditators, especially Western meditators, not so much in the East where people are raised sitting on the ground. It's painful to learn to sit on the ground and so forth, but you see the Thais and so forth, they just, most of the meditation halls are not, there's nothing, there's concrete on the floor. And they don't use cushions or mats. They just put, at most, they put down a cloth like I'm sitting on, just onto the concrete and snuggle in, just as if it was a big fat couch, and they're there. And once a week, they come for an all-night sitting to the monastery, and they spend the whole night till dawn, like from 6 in the evening till 5 in the morning, sitting there, happily smiling and meditating, listening to the monks give talks and so forth. And this is the way the body is when it's raised like this. I remember asking that we have a group of Thais that come and visit the monastery often, and asking them one time about Western meditators have a lot of pain in their legs, and what do you do when you have pain in your legs? And they were all, pain in their legs? What pain in their legs? After a couple of hours, don't you? No. Sickening. So it is a matter of inflexibility and not being used to it. Your leg going to sleep is not that it's not, some people feel that the blood circulation is being cut off to it. It's not really that. There are
very few amputee meditators walking around, one-legged meditators. It's just the nerve, a slight nerve pinch, which gives you that, you know, the numbing experience. So there's a number of tricks that you can do. Now, if you're sitting cross-legged, one thing that you can take the nail, your thumbnail, and sort of across the sole of your foot, just sort of dig it in and go like that, sharply and deeply, like that, with your thumbnail. Often this will bring your leg back awake, because actually you're stimulating nerves, and you understand that it's nerves that are giving you this impression that your leg is so-called gone to sleep, and sometimes that'll bring it back. Of course, it also just helps to learn. There's three or four different postures that are very easy to get to. You can sit what we call, this is called the polite posture in Thailand, one leg back, in other words, one leg is crossed like this and the other one is back. So it's sort of side saddle, or what do you call it, mermaid posture, polite posture. That's one, a very good meditation posture actually, especially if you sit on a cushion, it's very easy. And then you can, like windshield wipers, you can change sides, you move it, they move parallel back and forth. So you just lean forward and flip to the side, and that, now the knee is turning outwards instead of inwards. So that's at least two postures that you should know as alternatives. Then of course you have Burmese posture, that is sitting with your legs parallel but not crossed. In other words, your ankles don't cross but they are parallel. So that's called Burmese posture, very common in Burma. And in this posture, you tend to rest the hands on the knees. It's a very good posture too. It doesn't strain the legs. Then quarter lotus, that is, you just put it on the ankle or something. And then half lotus, so up like that. And then full lotus, put the other one over top. Those are all possible. Most people can't do full lotus, and most people have trouble even with half lotus. But Burmese is fairly acceptable, side saddle, mermaid posture, and then of course just sitting either with a bench or with a cushion, but turn the cushion on its side. One of these cushions, turn it on its side like this, and then sit at kneeling posture. This is where a good way to use these cushions too. Very comfortable that way. It's actually, even if you have a bench and you prefer to sit slightly differently, you can put the cushion down and sit kneeling on it. That's another option. And you can also sit like this. Especially if this one's asleep, leave that one there and keep your back up. This is called the gentleman's posture. There is the Korean gentleman's posture is, it's like this. Maybe a little awkward for you, but good for sitting out in a park and so forth. So those are, you should know about half a dozen or more different options for changing the posture. If you don't want to change the posture, sometimes what I found is sometimes just exhaling deeply and holding it out, just emptying the lungs and holding it out for a while, sometimes releases the changes something in the leg, and the nerve restores itself. So that's, you can also try that, just breathing out, holding it out. And you may find that there's a little bit of restoration of the nerves. And again, just scraping the sole of the foot, stimulate the nerves. Those are ways of getting your leg to come back to awake. Another way, not to worry too much about your leg being asleep. At least it doesn't hurt anymore.
It's only when it comes back awake that it hurts. And so your most of your pain is over, it's gone to sleep. And then the person finds it very distracting. So actually you just get used to this experience. And after a while, you also start to feel, you start to learn in meditation that by subtly, very subtly shifting from time to time, just a little bit, the pressure on the buttocks and the leg and so forth, that you can avoid this. It's by not paying attention to it that it kind of creeps up on you. So you'll find that as you get more and more experience, it's just a slight change of the pelvic tilt and motion one side to the other keeps this phenomena from occurring. As far as the word very distracting, again, it doesn't. That's another thing to work on. You know, it's just the relationship to having the body perfectly comfortable all the time. You know, it's a thing to work on. You know, finding some detachment from these unpleasant feelings is going to be very useful in your life. To be able to just watch these things without inflicting more distress on yourself by having anxiety about these uncomfortable feelings. If you work on it with these feelings, you will have much better chance when it comes to very distracting feelings. And certainly we are probably going to encounter some very painful feelings in our life. Getting sick, you know, all kinds of things happen to the body. And it would be very good, very useful to start to find some detachment from these feelings. Usually, you know, there are lots of people ask me, they have pain, chronic pain, and they ask me, what's the magic secret that monks know that eliminates all pain? I say, well, there isn't one, but of course you have to learn not to inflict the psychological pain. It is one feeling called, the Buddha calls it the first arrow. Somebody shoots you with an arrow. That is bodily feeling. And then you take another arrow and stick it into you. The second arrow is psychological distress over the first arrow. It doesn't help. So they all want to know how to become detached from pain or to eliminate pain. Now, in order to eliminate pain, you have to enter a deep state of concentration. You can't actually dissolve the pain if you enter jhana. But that requires a good, very sufficient concentration in order to do that. If you do that, you will, even if you have significant problem in the body, it will disappear. You can't have the bodily pain in these deep states of concentration. But when you come out, it's there again. It's waiting for you. So it's only a temporary relief. It certainly is a grand and profound and wonderful relief, and to cultivate jhana in general has a great benefit from all aspects of life. But so that's the only way you can just eliminate it. But the other one is just to cultivate more patience and detachment from it. I notice though that not too many people come up to me and ask me how they can get more detached from pleasure. They have a problem with pleasant feelings and they'd like to know how to get over it, you know. And of course it's two sides of the same coin. In order to practice detachment from pain, you're going to have to practice detachment from feelings in general. And there's three types: painful, pleasant, and neutral. And all three of them you have to start observing rather than just falling into and identifying. I am the pain. This is where the distress comes from. You're identifying with the pain. I am this pain. Instead of seeing it as a sensation. If you really look into it very deeply, and instead of in pain, you want to just jump out of your body. But you can't, so you have to go into it. So like I said before, you can't get out of it, get into it. Go towards it, investigate it, and go into it. And eventually, if you really look at it and stop talking about it to yourself as pain, you will see that it's not really pain. It is just some rich
and changing sensations. They're dramatic sensations, but you can lose the concept of pain by really examining them without labeling it or conceptualizing it as pain. And the same with pleasure. It's a way of getting over addictions, to examine more deeply exactly what you're experiencing. Sometimes mindfulness has been the beginning of the end of certain types of pleasure indulgences for people, because they realize when they actually pay attention to this, what they thought was a pleasure, it turns out that maybe it was a pleasure some time ago, or the first time you tried it, or whatever, but it hasn't really been since. It's just an idea that this is a pleasant experience. When you actually pay attention, and this happens actually automatically, almost against your will, when you start meditating, you start to notice things that you never noticed before. And life changes, because what you had actually having a substitute experience, by something supposed to be fun, supposed to be pleasant, etc., and you're having a vicarious or substitute experience, not actually having the direct real experience. By practicing meditation a lot, you're dropping the screens and interpretations of experience. You actually see what's going on directly, and often it's not what you thought it was. Literally, it's not what you thought it was, because you're thinking the experience rather than experiencing the experience. And this is why meditation changes your life. You can't. It's kind of, you don't always like it. I mean, and some say, sometimes you think, maybe I shouldn't have started this meditation business. Or there are moments when you say, I wish I'd never heard of it. Because you're just uncertain about what the experience is. The changes that take place, whether you like them or not, because you're putting in causes, remember. By doing this, just by watching your breath, trying to watch your breath, trying to pay attention and be in this presence, every time you do that, you have just put in a cause, which must have a result. And the result will appear whether you like it or not, just in the same way that if you haven't put in the causes, the result won't appear whether you like it or not. But if you do put in these causes, things happen. And sometimes you're not so sure you like it. You're not so sure you approve of it. I assure you that eventually you will approve of it, but at first, because you're changing in unforeseen ways, it's a little bit of it's an adventure. And we all are a little bit hesitant to go into the unknown, aren't we? Even though that's why people stay the same. Despite the fact that it's not very satisfactory, it's at least it's the known. At least you know what it's about. So that's the condition that people become automatic or automatons. They stay with the known. It's very unsatisfactory, but it is the known. And so that the known for the ordinary person is really ignorance. What they feel as to be the known is actually their ignorance. The unknown is actually knowledge. And so we're trying to go from ignorance to knowledge. And that means that whenever you have the sensation that you're safe and in a familiar place, you're probably not learning. You're not going towards knowledge. You're staying with misknowledge or non-knowledge or ignorance. And it's so that the experience of meditation and of the spiritual journey is always kind of going into the unknown. And that's where knowledge lies. The knowing is where knowledge lies. You know that story about the man who dropped this key outside of his house, and he's down on his hands and he's looking around for his key out there. And it's night. Somebody comes along and says, what are you looking for? He says, I dropped my key. So that this fellow helps him. He's under the street light. And they're crawling around on their hands and knees, and they search every square centimeter of that pool of light. It's just not here. Where did you drop it? Oh, over there. Well, what are we doing looking around over here? There's more light over here. So that is what we do. The key really is, the key represents the key to getting into your house, to get, you know, out of this uncomfortable situation. But because you don't want to go into the dark, where it is, where it, in the area that's lit up in your life, the known area is unsatisfactory. It doesn't hold the key. So it's obviously, you have to go into the dark. You have to go into the unknown to find the key. But we kind of humor ourselves or feel like we're doing something by keep staying in a known area. We keep going around in circles in our known area if we're afraid to grow and go into the unknown. So that has to do with your leg going to sleep. What is the difference between rebirth and reincarnation? Well, about four letters are different there, I'd say, offhand. Rebirth is, I mean, these are English words, and they have kind of picked up a meaning. There are specific terms in Pali that would refer to this, but rebirth is more or less what the Buddhist approach to this subject is. We would use the word rebirth rather than reincarnation. Basically, reincarnation implies that an identity, a self-same identity, kind of a fixed soul, goes out of this body and goes into the next body. And that's the idea of reincarnation. I reincarnated into the next body. From a Buddhist point of view, this is a kind of a naive misunderstanding of what happens. And they say there is no fixed identity that goes from one life to the next. In fact, there is no fixed identity in one life. What's going on is there is no identity. Identity means that something stays the same through time. There's a little you somewhere inside your body, a little me. That's the same me that was there yesterday, and the same me that will be there tomorrow. And that people walk around with that kind of, this is the basic assumption about their self. You may not be able to articulate it or anything, but there's a kind of a presumed sense that there's a me in there somewhere. Me, I'm looking out. I'm the one. I used to think this way. Now I think that way. But somehow there's something about me that's the same. So the Buddha, that is the essence of what the Buddha is talking about. The central teaching, he says, no, there isn't one. There's no you in there. Everything is changing about your mind and your feelings and your consciousness. It's all changing. And that's the only way you can know of it. The idea of a fixed, unchanging self, the thing couldn't have any experience if it was unchanging. How could it know anything? Experience anything. Like a marble or a stone or something. It has no, in order to know, you must change. There has to be change to know. So it is just a causal process, like a series of dominoes tapping into each other. The first domino doesn't go to the end of the line. It just falls down, knocks into the second, and energy, some form of energy passes between one domino and the next. Some form of energy. And a particular, like if the domino is a little bit facing off on an angle, it'll knock into the next domino in a different way, and it'll cause that one to fall in a different way. So each little moment of energy conditions the next moment, like a series of dominoes. And that's the last domino of this life falls over and knocks into the first domino of the next life, and the series just continues. So that's rebirth. From the incarnation kind of idea is that a little domino from this train is taken up and put into the next situation and carried along the whole way. And then taken out and put into the next one, carried along the whole way. So the Buddha, this is very, it sounds abstract, but this is actually the liberating knowledge, is to break out of the sense, the assumed concept of self, of me. You get over this sense, that all of the problems that go along with a fixed sense of identity dissolve. Now you're relating to reality as it is. It's a changing, flowing process without an entity in the middle of it, an unchanging entity. You are not who you were when you were 3 years old. There's nothing left of the 3-year-old. There's all kinds of processes that are connecting, but you're not, you know, there's, you can't say that you are the same one that you were when you were 3 years old. Your body, every cell of your body has changed. What's left? On the other hand, you're not entirely different either. Right. There's overlaps in memories and things. But even if you look at memory, if you remember your, if when you're 10 years old and you remember being 6 years old, that's different than when you're 20 years old and you remember being 6 years old. The memory, it changes because new knowledge and perceptions have come in. So you're, even your memory and perceptions of who you were changes all the time. So memory is, I remember, was it last night or this morning, I was talking about change, watching change. It's not you watching change. It's change watching change. See, with the sense of that, because there's nouns in the English language, we believe that there are nouns out in the world. There's an apple, and there's somebody named Don, or Bill, or Jane. But actually, there isn't anybody named Don or Bill or Jane. Those are just convenient words. Actually, it's not Jane; it's Janie. Person is Janie, and the other person is Billy, you know, Donnie. They're verbs. We are.